Select your program.
Dialogue.
Program initiated.
Approach the threshold. Engage rationality. Open your mind. Godspeed.
Torpedoing through space to your listening devices. This is Flagship Freedom, the podcast that places you on the front line in the war of ideas. I am Michael.
And I'm Danny Boy.
And we welcome you back to the podcast once again with, as promised, a guest episode. We're doing quite a few of these. We're calling them dialogue episodes, aren't we, Danny?
That's true, Michael.
Gotta get my terminology.
You blew
right.
It.
I blew it. What'd you think about this one? I mean, we had a fantastic conversation, by the way. We were talking with Rayford Davis, who is a former police officer, and he has turned into essentially an advocate for the ending of the war on drugs, as well as a libertarian and actually a self-proclaimed voluntarist. So that's pretty cool, huh?
This guy is awesome. He exhibits a level of self-awareness and just self-critical analysis that very, very few people have the balls to espouse. He looks back on his career with a certain level of regret, but he's able to encapsulate and understand the world that he was in, and really just extremely intelligent guy. Very encouraging. I think everybody needs to hear this episode, especially those coming from the more conservative side of the aisle. This is an ex-cop. Been there, done that, you know, went in with a good can-do attitude, wants to make a difference, and realized it's all wrong. And he was working within a terribly corrupt and backwards system, even though he had good intentions. So I loved it. I look forward to talking with the guy again. I thought it was awesome.
The way that he goes about communicating things is not so much a condemnation of the Brotherhood in Blue, so to speak, but rather a plea to them to first recognize what they're doing as a morally bankrupt action or set of actions or system, and then moving forward to making an actual change within their life so that their careers align with their moral principles is the way that he petitions those people that are in the law enforcement, I imagine, is very, very effective. And I'm hoping that many of the people who are in the law enforcement, as well as, yeah, of course, our conservatives who tend to be a little bit more sympathetic towards the men with the badges, I think all of these individuals need to listen to this episode. But even if you aren't a conservative and if you are not in the law enforcement agency, you are going to get some value out of this one. So, Danny, let's...
Without further ado, go for it.
Yeah, all right. All right, ladies and gentlemen, our guest is a former police officer with the City of North Charleston Police Department of South Carolina that made a startling discovery over the course of his career that altered the trajectory of his life and his mission thereafter. Retiring from the force in 2006, our guest became an advocate for police reform and a staunch critic of the so-called war on drugs. Rayford Davis, welcome to the flagship.
Thank you, Michael and Danny, for having me on.
Oh, it's our pleasure. It's our pleasure. We talk about quite a few things on the program, from philosophy to current events. We've had a myriad guests on board, and sometimes there are people that really have some fascinating stories that we want to share with the rest of our listeners. And not only do you have a fascinating story, but you have a strong personal experience that informs your philosophy, and it gives us a man on the ground that can tell us a lot about the inner workings of it, the philosophy of the police force, the philosophy of the war on drugs. And the fact that you've made that about face is really a fantastic thing, and I'm really looking forward to getting into it. Before we do all of that, I want to give the listeners a little bit of a background as to your experience leading up to your retirement. You're leaving the police force.
Right. So I started as a police officer in 2002, the City of North Charleston, population about 80,000. At the time, we were the eighth most dangerous city.
Really? Charleston? North Charleston,
yeah, like a per capita. We had one of the highest murder and crime victimization rates.
Wow.
And so I started in 2002. I was a patrol officer for 4 years, and then I moved to detective division. I investigated child abuse and child sexual assaults for 2 years. Now my career was cut short. I was directing traffic at a car accident and got hit by a pickup truck and broke my leg. And so that's how I got out from a police officer. But, you know, I was highly motivated. I wanted to serve my community and help everybody. I had a bachelor's degree in criminal justice. I was a little bit older. I was 29 years old, married and a kid. So I figured I had good judgment and good education and level headed. So if there's anybody that would be a good cop, it would be me. And, you know, cops do good work. But I saw where a lot of what we did was very counterproductive, and it just didn't kind of set right with my conscience. But everything we did was legal now. But I saw that we actually, in a lot of ways, were the violent aggressors in our communities. And a lot of what we did ended up destabilizing our communities that we were trying to help.
Was there a single, maybe a watershed moment in your experience leading up to, obviously it was sort of a forced retirement, but it seems like it may have been a fortuitous moment in other ways, something like of a silver lining where you actually had, as far as what I've read about you, you were having a philosophical awakening over the course of your career. But was there a moment in your career that you're like, I've got to get out, but I don't really have a good opportunity. I don't know how to do it.
On a patrol officer, the drug war really, really got to me in the drug enforcement. Now, a lot of these drug dealers and, you know, thugs and whatever else you want to call them are real easy to hate. And there's a lot of violence and they do cause a lot of problems in the community. But just something wasn't quite right, us running around, grabbing people off the streets, pulling them out of their cars, or, shoving guns in their faces and dragging them out of their homes and putting their hands down in their pants and pockets and digging through cars looking for drugs. This is with a consensual adult, so, you know, the harmful substance, but it was voluntary use and trade between them. And so what really business did we have? Oh, sure, it was legal, but it was unsettling. And so I wasn't real keen on it. So I found a way to kind of get out from the drug enforcement. And that's when I went over into the child abuse and child assault division to investigate real crimes. Let me get into real crimes there. That's got to be it. And got in there and we saw real crimes. We had real abuse and victims, but we even with that, I saw that law enforcement really did a terrible job of investigating cases, and very often just how the process worked, we caught up a lot of people that were in fact not guilty, but were still charged and processed through this horrendous system. And if it was a watershed moment, it was one case where a man was accused of sexually abusing like his stepdaughter, teenage stepdaughter. Mm-hmm. And, you know, whether he did it or not, frankly, I have no clue. But I was uncomfortable with it. I'm like, look, if I were before I was, we were debating with my sergeant about whether or not to charge this man. And, I told him, hey, I'm the investigator. I know as much about this case as anyone. And if I was on the jury, I would not convict this man. And I don't feel comfortable charging him if I wouldn't convict him on the jury. And it was like a record scratching. Brr, my sergeant's like, whoa, no, you got to charge him. You know, you let the courts and the prosecutors figure all that out. So I charged him. And, of course, the guy went to jail. And a bit later, I got a call from the prosecutor. This case was finally going to court, but at that point, I knew I had to get out because I knew that was me personally that was going to charge that man and put him in jail, whether he was guilty or not. I don't know, but he very well may have been innocent. And for me to put him in jail over that, that was on me and on my conscience. And I didn't feel right with that. And that was kind of my moment when I said, you know what, I've got to get out of here. You see a lot of cops self-destruct for lots of different reasons. And so, you know, I was just kind of one of those in the list. Just to give you an understanding or an idea of kind of the attrition rate in law enforcement. When I started in 2002 with North Charleston, again, 300-man police force, my badge number was 279. And about every year and a half, they would re-sort the badge numbers. You would kind of move up, you know, as I was getting out in 2007, my badge number on the list was going to be 181. So that's how many police officers went to different departments, left, resigned, a few retired. But that's kind of that attrition rate. And what I call just kind of self-destructing, either on the job or off, or just kind of getting out. And I think a lot of it has to do with this moral injury, not so much the PTSD, but the crisis of conscience that police officers have for doing things they're told is right, but deep down and morally they know is unjustified.
I find your case fascinating. In one of the ways, because it reminds me of myself, I used to be a staunch conservative, and I distinctly remember voting in the 2008 elections that I wanted medical marijuana to remain illegal. And I knew that people who used it would get thrown in jail. And, you know, it had never even occurred to me now as a staunch voluntarist, it never even occurred to me that, hey, that's actually an evil thing that you're advocating for, that peaceful people be jailed for something that they're not hurting anybody else. They're using their exercise and self-ownership over their own bodies. But you seem to be an exception in that you realized that this was wrong. You know, a lot of people, it takes a tap on the shoulder. It takes some outside event for them to even just wake up, because it's something that we're just born into and we never question. We never question the nature of government, et cetera. So I wonder if you can touch on that, on not only drugs, but just the very nature of police work. As you know now, being more philosophically enlightened and advanced since you were a police officer, you realize the nature of the state, and that without enforcement, without the aggression of the state, particularly that of police officers, the state law would mean nothing, right? Law is nothing without enforcement. So in terms of the morality of using aggression against peaceful people, is this something that you knew, or that, well, you as well as other police officers, that you kind of innately know, or is it something that never even occurs to people until they're told?
It's look at how you're taught everything. real quick, what's the supreme law of the land?
The Constitution,
right?
I suppose, right?
Of course, yes, the Constitution. And so, you know, we're drilled. That's drilled into us from a very young age. And of course, that's what, you know, everything was taught. And I read the court cases in my education that say, hey, all these drug laws, they're constitutional. I don't really agree with them, you know, maybe, or something like that. But hey, the law is the law. So the Supreme Court just says good, so it must be good. But the supreme law of the land is morality. Laws cannot alter morality. We know that. You ask, was slavery moral when it was legal? Of course not. Internment of Japanese citizens in California during World War II, was that moral? Of course not. But it was legal. But is there any laws that we do today that maybe are immoral? Oh, no. All the laws that we do today are okay. You know, we're just this one point in history. We've got 100,000 laws, but no, they're all moral. They're the moral because they're legal. You know, we do that, the kind of reflective reverse justification. So, no, we're not. You know, we are taught about morality in kind of an ethics kind of way, and cops are too, but that comes later. So first you say, you know, am I legally justified to put handcuffs on someone? You know, am I illegally justified? Am I following policy? to be justified in where I'm at and putting my hands on someone. And then after all of that, you check off yes, yes, yes. Then you ask, is this what I'm doing moral? And it's kind of more like an ethical or compassionate kind of thing. Well, maybe you kind of cut this person a little slack or something because, you know, the interest of justice is not quite right. But no, the first thing you ask is what you're doing moral? And if it's no, you don't go any further. But that is, we're not ever taught that. When have you ever heard that? It wasn't until much later to when I saw that. And then I've got to say, well, everything that I learned was wrong. All of my professors were wrong. The Supreme Court is wrong. My sergeant was wrong. My chief, my pastor, everyone else was actually terribly deluded. And not only that, but I harmed people. I believed it. And I thought I was doing the right thing. And my actions harmed people. And then I've got to turn around and admit that. That's very difficult on your ego, and it's not something that's easy to do.
And isn't that shocking that good people like you, obviously a very, very decent, good human being, just by the way you're talking, you can tell it's obvious that good people can be manipulated or brainwashed, for lack of a better term, into doing bad things. I mean, that just, to me, that's really shocking, but I've seen it in myself previously. And I give you, by the way, all the credit in the world for having come, you know, 180 degrees to evaluate what you've done and admit that it's not the right thing. I consider you a hero for that reason. So thank you very much for that. But how amazing it is that good people can be made to do bad things.
Well, you know, I do appreciate it. You know, I've certainly got some karma, you know, I feel that I have to pay back. And let me just say about cops, that's the thing. If you say, well, this problem with policing and law enforcement is bad cops, and everybody I worked with were great people, you know, or good people, motivated, want to do the right thing. You know, you had good and bad days and kind of better cops than others. But, you know, generally they're all well motivated. They're not evil individuals. And so if you look at them as evil and that's how you're going to fight them, that's, you're not going to get very far. You have to understand that. Yes, what they are doing is morally wrong and unjust, but they don't understand that. And so you kind of have to change their minds. And the reason that I am so forceful and speak out is, one, yes, I did harm people, and I have to, you know, kind of make amends for that by speaking out. But also, I love cops. I love cops. I'm a cop. That's my people. That's my tribe. And so I want to save them and prevent them from not only harming people. That's, you know, that's good, but I don't want them to harm themselves. And so that's why I'm not going to back down. I am going to speak out about this and say, look, what you're doing is morally wrong, and you are harming your own conscience and spirituality. By continuing to ignore it and to justify your actions with unjust government laws.
Rayford, there is this pervasive thought process of the dichotomous good cop, bad cop. And, you know, you've heard that. I'm not sure if that's terminology that's used within the force, but it's certainly used outside, and I'm sure you've heard of it. Is there a type that the police recruit from? That obviously they want to find good people, but people that are also going to follow the rules, the law and order type of people. They're going to follow directives. But is there a type of person that the police recruits specifically?
Well, you know, our department, which is considered a very aggressive department, they still, you know, when they recruited, they were not. They're looking for highly motivated people, but they're looking for people that can be, compassionate and understanding and realize, you know, there's cultural issues, you know, black, white, and Hispanic and those and, you know, male and female and all these different issues going on, you know, to be understanding and compassionate. They certainly were. And so they actually put a great bit of effort to which, you know, they look for cops that were educated and everything. But then they turn right around and they train you to use violence and to use force. And so really it doesn't matter what type of person they kind of start with. That's how you're all trained. And just with every just basic interactions on the street, you are to gain compliance with the subject. You know, those are the type of very dehumanizing words you use. And so you have this use of force continuum, and just how they train you, actually, you kind of create the conditions for a confrontation. And then you use that force and that ratchets it up. It's very when you're in it and training, you don't understand it, but you sit back and look at it now and you realize that it is actually, that's how we're just basically trained to create those conflicts. And of course it shows in our arrest rates and assault rates and everything else.
So there is a fundamental disconnect between the kinds of people they're trying to recruit, but also the program.
Then they train it right out of them.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. So, okay. And now let me give you a background of why I asked this question. And of course, everyone has their own personal anecdote, but this one I found particularly shocking. I, of course, I'm not going to use any names or cities or anything like this. I used to room with someone who ended up joining the force, but before they joined, they have all sorts of character interviews where they interview roommates and friends and all sorts of things. This individual was in a fraternity at one point in time, and so they interviewed fraternity brothers too. And this fella I absolutely knew was unfit. Not only was he extremely aggressive, but he was also, and I don't use this word very lightly, but extremely homophobic. He had an aggression towards homosexuals and those of different skin colors too. I didn't find him to be a very fitting individual for a member of the police force. And I gave this information within the interview, my very, very staunch opposition to this person joining. And I know several other individuals because we talked about it. We were like, hey, you got a call from him. You got a call from him. What do they say? So everyone was in opposition to this person joining the police force. And we all had our different stories about how this person would not be a very good candidate. Anyways, sure enough, a couple months later, I saw on Facebook the guy's hired. It was just shocking to everyone. We all messaged each other at once. We could not believe that this city hired somebody like this. And if things like this happen in cities, and this is like some regular upscale neighborhood here in Michigan, if this sort of recruitment process happens here, what kinds of really shoddy recruitment processes are happening all over the rest of the country in places where maybe there's such a demand for police, but they just can't get it? Are they lowering the bar even further than this?
Well, you have that, but again, that's an ancillary problem in a lot of ways. Look at me. I was 29, married, stable guy, been in the community, had a bachelor's degree, and not this crazy type, type A, just, Farva, kind of guy or something like that. No, nothing. So you take me. Did I help the community? No, I caused all kind of mayhem, and I worked very hard to follow the law. And so it's an ancillary. It is a problem, and it just basic with accountability, the lack of accountability with law enforcement.
The reason why I bring something up like this is that if there are recruitment processes that are so underdeveloped or uncritical of the character and the nature of some of these police officers, and of course you're saying, you've seen contrary evidence, and I certainly believe you, but if this sort of thing is happening, then you have to wonder what kind of other fundamental assumptions are happening that would really amount to a sort of self-preservation of what is going on in the status quo, so that if men like you step up and say this is being done poorly, how stubborn are they going to be in order to preserve the status quo, the way of living? Because all life forms are like that, and many organizations are like that. The police force shouldn't be one of them, because they are here to protect and serve, or at least that is the basic assumption.
Well, a lot of it has to go for this. especially with conservatives, mm-hmm. is you have this just blind worship, you know, thank you for your service and this, all this thin blue
line
stuff.
Right. Yeah.
And everything, and talking about honor and integrity and all of that, mm-hmm. and that huge mantra. So they automatically believe it. So they say, well, everybody says thank you for your service and you're doing a wonderful job and thank you for putting yourself on the line. So we must be doing the right thing. And again, you have that kind of reverse self-justification, and that prevents you from any honest reflection and introspection. And how we measure our police performance is upside down. They use it by their visible activity. Getting tougher is considered a success rate or a measure of success. Your arrest rates are considered a measure of success. And that's totally opposite of what you just have. And that's against even Sir Robert Peel's, fundamental principles of policing.
And that's the father of policing.
The father of modern policing.
Yeah, right.
Well, Rayford, do you consider yourself a voluntarist?
Yes. And I'll talk about the policing. Two things real quick is – and why I turned away from a lot of it is it doesn't work. And so I saw that what we were doing was very counterproductive, wasteful, and unjust. And it didn't work. And so just from a practical perspective, it didn't work. And then for a voluntarist, yes, the non-aggression principle. When that always rolled in my head, even as a cop, when is it okay to use force against another person? It rolled through scenarios in my head. If I pull somebody over and they don't roll down their window or they don't get out of their car, how far can I really push that? I mean, and you could work it up legally to end up shooting them. Legally, it would be okay. And that just didn't sit right with me. So when is it okay to use force against another man? And it is never okay to initiate violence. It is okay to defend yourself against aggression, but it is never okay to initiate force, fraud, or coercion against another person, period.
Mike, this guy's pure gold. I haven't. There's no
badge. There's no state statute or anything like that that can alter that fundamental principle. And can I just say something real quick about the word violence and force? And I even make this mistake too. But for people talking about when is it okay to use violence? Well, it's never okay to use violence. And you're like, you mean I can't defend myself? No, that's different. Of course you can defend yourself.
Yeah, well, you're certainly property. Not pacifist.
Correct. We'll get to that in a minute, but we'll pull on that thread a little bit further. But violence is immoral and unjust physical force or aggression against another person. Violence, violate. So if you think about violence as an immoral use of force, and then just regular aggression or physical force would be justified. Does that make sense?
Well, aggression is not justified.
Right. Not aggression, but physical force can be okay.
Right.
When
you
initiate physical force, that's violence and that's wrong. It has violate in the root of the word, and so it becomes. That's why when you use that word violence sometimes back and forth, it clouds the issues.
Yeah, and I'm glad you brought that up. To be precise with definitions, one thing that can be confusing to people is, well, what about using force to defend my property? I mean, that sort of seems like the initiation of force, but when you dig down deep enough, you realize, well, using or taking someone else's property is actually the initiation of theft. So to respond with force, to remove a trespasser or to stop a thief, again, would not be considered aggression. Would you agree with that statement?
I certainly would. And here's Murray Rothbard, and he even kind of uses the word violent. I would change it too. This is what he said. Violent defense then must be confined to violent invasion. And see, I would use, you know, physical defense must be combined to violent invasion, either actually, implicitly, or by direct and overt threat. So by how far does the right of defense go? I mean, and he says, for one thing, it would be clearly grotesque and criminally invasive to shoot a man across the street because his angry look seemed to you to portend an invasion. The danger must be immediate and overt. We might say clear and present. And he goes on. And so, yeah, that's kind of the danger. And then we could go further. And again, I'm not a pacifist, but even when you're justified in using physical force to defend yourself, quite often it is more costly to you and everyone else use it. And so, you know, that's kind of that you know, the Christian principle and Jesus parable of, you know, turning the other cheek and off, you know, offering another man your cloak. Are you justified in using physical force? Yes. Should you? You know, maybe not. Maybe you should just kind of take the offense and move on out because you act out of love towards another person and not.
Yes, very good. And one of the other things that I think needs to be bound up, we've talked about this in previous podcasts, is the idea of the symmetry of the force. If, let's say, someone comes to your property and steals a bike, perhaps you can stop them physically. It would be very distasteful and morally. If you take a person's life over a bike, that's going to sit with you for the rest of your life. It should be very much in line with the nature of the event that is occurring, to which you would be willing to take someone else's life in order to stop whatever given action it is, even if it is justified. Go ahead.
That's correct. And let me get into a policing aspect. Mm-hmm. You know, as a police officer, or, you know, someone whose, you know, full-time job it is to protect others, and you're considered yourself a professional, you have to hold yourself to even higher standard. And so you have to go to these really superhuman lengths before you use force and harm a person, even no matter, you know, what kind of violent or criminal they are, you know, a real criminal. You still even have to really take it to a high level before you use force. Currently, police officers, man, we lock people up, you know, just left and right.
Yeah.
That's kidnapping, basically. I mean, that's what you're doing. You're taking someone's freedom from them, locking them in a cage, and threatening to shoot them if they resist enough.
This is amazing. Everyone needs to hear this. I've never heard somebody who was, not only were you, you know, taught these things your entire life since your upbringing, you were not only within the belly of the beast, you are the enforcement arm of the beast. And now you've come to see that what you were doing was counterproductive. Like, this needs to be broadcast from every radio. We need to hijack and violate the property rights. But I just can't get over it. This is really great.
Rayford,
yes, go ahead. All right. Please. Well, I'll say to that, you know, a lot of police officers say, well, I'm just following orders. You know, if you don't like it, change the law. And what you said, you know, about police officers out there causing that harm, that is true. An unjust law, say this, you know, you talk about marijuana or something, you know, that prevents somebody from possessing it. That's just ink and paper. It is that police officer, that's me, Rayford Davis, that I go up to someone and I take them and I put my hands on them and put the handcuffs on them and take away their physical freedom. That is me bringing that harm into physical manifestation. And so I have the most moral culpability because I'm the one that brought it into existence, brought that harm into existence. And so individual police officers and people that they have to understand, they have the most responsibility. So they have the highest duty to stop causing harm and reflect and make those conscious decisions on themselves to no longer enforce unjust laws.
And I'm glad you just want to throw this out there real quick. I'm glad you make the distinction between unjust laws, and there are plenty of just laws out there, laws which are a reflection of natural law. That is,
right,
don't steal,
right,
don't murder. So, you know, people get confused. They say, oh my God, you don't want policing in general. And no, of course not. We just don't want enforcement of arbitrary legal edicts. We're totally fine with the policing as a valuable service in society.
Theft, burglary, assault, murder, rape, all of those. Am I saying that cops are immoral for using, for putting handcuffs on someone like that? And of course not. No.
I wish we had some more time to talk, because I really wanted to get into some of the conversations of the drug war. And it looks like we are running out of time, though, so we will certainly have you back on, Rayford. But in the meantime, I wanted to ask you where our listeners can find you on the web. Where can we direct them?
Okay, you can find me on Twitter at Rayford D. So I'm on there. You can contact me through there. I'm a member of LEAP. That's Law Enforcement Against Prohibition. And actually, we kind of rebranded a little bit. It's now a Law Enforcement Action Partnership, where I'm a member of them. We speak out against drug prohibition and advocate for drug legalization and the end of other abusive policing practices. And so you can find me there and other people like me. And hey, I'm not the only one. And then you can find me at blog occasionally at blueenmity.blogspot and also at the Libertarian Institute. You can check me out there. A recent post was Murder in Service of the Drug War.
Excellent. Well, we will post all of those things on our show notes as usual. But in the meantime, thank you very much, Rayford, for joining us on the flagship. It was truly a pleasure to have you and to speak with you about your experiences in the force. And we congratulate you for making this decision. I mean, the fact that you're able to join us and to be able to express the wonders of libertarianism is makes us happy.
Michael Nadani, I appreciate you having me on and giving me the opportunity to speak out.
Thank you very much.
All right. Well, listeners, remember, this is Flagship Freedom, the podcast that places you on the front line in the war of ideas. Until our next battle, so long and farewell.
See you next time.
And that one desire is you. And I know nobody else ain't gonna do.